On a dark desert highway, cool wind in my hair, warm smell of Calitas rising up through the air. Up ahead in the distance, I saw a shimmering light. My head grew heavy and my sight grew dim. I had to stop for the night. There she stood in the doorway. I heard the mission bell. And I was thinking to myself, this could be heaven or this could be hell. Then she lit up a candle and she showed me the way. There were voices down the corridor. I thought I heard them say, welcome to the Hotel California. Such a lovely place, such a lovely face. Plenty of room at the Hotel California. Any time of year, you can find it here. Her mind is Tiffany twisted. She got the Mercedes Benz. She got a lot of pretty, pretty boys that she calls friends. How they dance in the courtyard, sweet summer sweat. Some dance to remember, some dance to forget. So I called up the captain, please bring me my wine. He said, we haven't had that spirit here since 1969. And still those voices are calling from far away. Wake you up in the middle of the night just to hear them say, welcome to the Hotel California. Such a lovely place, such a lovely face. They're living it up at the Hotel California. What a nice surprise. Bring your alibis. Mirrors on the ceiling, the pink champagne on ice. She said, we are just prisoners here of our own device. And in the master's chambers, they gathered for the feast. They stab it with their steely knives, but they just can't kill the beast. The last thing I remember, I was running for the door. I had to find the passage back to the place I was before. Relax, said the night man, we are programmed to receive. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave. Welcome to the Hotel California, such a lovely place. Such a lovely face. Plenty of room at the Hotel California. Any time of year, you can find it here. I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported radio, so make sure you head on over there to revolution.radio or freedomslips.com. Look for one of their great products to buy, or just find the donation button. But one way or another, it'd be a great thing to support Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And now I am very happy to introduce our first guest of the evening, Sheena Zuri Powell, who should be on the line already. Welcome to the show, Sheena.
Hello, good evening, Chuck. How are you today? Thanks for having me on.
I'm doing great. I'm looking forward to hearing some interesting stuff from you.
Thank you. Chuck, that was such a great song, The Hotel California. Thanks for presenting that, and your rendition is really powerful. And there's a lyric in that song towards the beginning. I was thinking to myself, this could be heaven or this could be hell. That reminds me of a letter that I read from the poet Chaim Plutzik, and he wrote this letter to his friend Pablo Picasso. And he was talking about Spain, in which he said, God and the devil are often hard to tell apart. That is the Spanish problem, Pablo. And I love that quote. I think it's so, so powerful, because this, you know, good and bad, heaven, hell, God, devil, it's always around us in our society, especially nowadays.
Definitely.
Chuck, I wanted to know if I can start actually by, you know, reading a powerful poem written by my dear friend and mentor, the poet and activist Sherwood Ross, who we all know and miss. He was such a prolific writer, speaking out for what is right in the world and, you know, for the good and against the evil, against war, racism, hatred. And
yes,
as poignant and at times scathing was his commentary here on New American Dream and other outlets, poetry has really touched something deeper and gentler within us as human beings. And we can be outraged and still express it in such a thoughtful and intelligent way, just as Sherwood did in Jesus in Mississippi, an excerpt of which I read on the last show that I was on here with you.
Yeah.
So I would love to read. It's a short poem. It's called The Killers of Lorca, and it was written about the poet Federico Garcia Lorca.
Well, I look forward to hearing it. Please go ahead.
Thank you. This is The Killers of Lorca, written by Sherwood Ross. Cursed be the killers of Lorca, down to their last generation, down to their last descendant on earth. Let them bathe in my vituperation. Cursed be Francisco Franco, first among the four insurgent generals, bombers of cities, killers of children, destroyers of Madrid. Cursed be their memories, and cursed be those loyalists who killed the priests who threw them alive down the cliffs, who burned them alive in their churches, who revenged themselves like any Hun upon their enemies and settled old scores at the barrel of a gun. Let them all shovel coal for the devil for all eternity. I couldn't care less, these creatures who made the slaughter. May they break their backs and burn their feet in hell forever, without even a drink of water. That was The Killers of Lorca.
Wow. Very powerful.
It is powerful, Chuck. In an impressive society, the artists are the first to go, and then the philosophers, and then the scientists, etc.
Yeah.
And there's a long-lasting legacy of what anyone in power leaves behind. So someone who is a dictator like Francisco Franco will leave a legacy of hatred. So we can either leave behind the legacy of good and peace, or one of evil and destruction, or anything in between. I've actually just returned from a trip to Spain, where the mark of Francisco Franco is still felt some 80 years after the Spanish Civil War. So I found that very, very amazing to see that impact still lingering, even so south as Sevilla.
Yeah.
Federico Garcia Lorca, the poet about whom Sherwood wrote in The Killers of Lorca, he was a Spanish poet, and he was born in the region where I was visiting, in Andalusia, which is the southern part of Spain. He was born there in the late 1800s in the same, close to the town where Pablo Picasso was born, actually. Lorca was born in Granada, and Picasso was born in Malaga, both in Andalusia. And Lorca was part of an avant-garde group of artists when he was coming up in his creativity, spending time with Salvador Dali and other famous artists known as the Generation of 27. And he also spent time in New York City, which no doubt shaped his views in a very creative and open ways. And despite the threat of fascism back in Spain when Franco was coming into power, Lorca refused to hide his leftist political views. And then this is what Sherwood Ross alludes to in his poem. And in the mid-30s, when the Spanish Civil War was coming into play and really coming about, the poet, the artist Lorca, was arrested in Granada, where he was born, and he was executed by Francisco Franco's firing squad.
Wow.
So this is the story behind the killers of Lorca. It's incredible. It's incredible.
Indeed. Yeah.
And even it seems very poignant, even with what's happening today in the world. And in Sevilla, where I was spending time, it was a hot topic of conversation because Francisco Franco's body was to be removed and his grave moved to another location in Spain to be with his family remains. And there was a point of contention among many. It was a very, very hot topic. And even in the little old town where I was staying, it was front page news in the morning paper. And I read a scathing editorial written by a young journalist. And he cried out I'm reading this in Spanish, right? Where, when is it enough is enough to keep talking about Franco? It's everywhere. And this dictator's legacy is still like a scourge in the country. And even while I visited a local bar attended by young artists, musicians, poets, I met a young poet named Marta, and she was all of 22. And she was so expressive about Franco and how it affected her family and how she's drawn to the arts. So it's a way of expressing and a way of getting around that type of oppressive thing, that kind of oppressive view, and trying to replace it with something that's more positive, with art, with poetry. So I was really, really taken aback by that.
Well, that's really something, Sheena. Let me ask you this. Do they honor Franco, or do they remember him with horror, or something in between?
Well, this flavor is very difficult to get a real reading on, because Franco passed away in 1975. And he was pretty much the man in charge, especially in the center of Spain, in Madrid. You see a lot of his loyal nationalists that are still reveling in Franco's work and ideology. But in places out in Barcelona, where the Republicans were more prominent, and you might remember Ernest Hemingway fighting for the Republicans during the Spanish Civil War, and also covering it with the award-winning journalist Gellhorn. They were fighting against it. So you'll see in those regions, and I was talking to a local, an older man named Jose, at Café Los Dardos in Sevilla, and he was telling me that the Catalans are very much separate from a lot of Spain for various political reasons. And Frankel is you know, not seen in a very good light up there, for sure.
Uh-huh. It's, I ask because of the ongoing controversy over pulling down Confederate memorials and so forth, which in a way I can certainly, you know, agree that the, you know, we don't want to honor people who were in favor of slavery, but at the same time I worry that we will lose sight of history, and so I was just curious how this same somewhat analogous situation is being handled in other countries, Spain.
It sounds familiar, doesn't it? It sounds very, very familiar.
It sure does.
But I agree with you, Chuck, in that certainly we don't have to memorialize these atrocities, but you need to keep these stories alive so as not to forget them and so as not to repeat those mistakes. And so
exactly.
We're supposed to learn something. Even on an individual basis, as human beings, we're supposed to learn from our mistakes, and we're supposed to grow and evolve and become better people.
Yes.
The same is for human populations, you know. The same is for regions and for countries. Frankel had a lot of impact. Talking about the Catalonia in the northeast of Spain.
Yeah.
There was a massive migration of like refugees of the Civil War that went to France and Paulac, and this is in the Basque region, like north of the Basque region.
Yeah.
And the poet Pablo Neruda was an ambassador to France. He was some kind of political ambassador to France, and he was charged with helping these refugees to escape the fascist push of Franco during the war. And he actually was in charge of overhauling the SS Winnipeg in 1939 to accommodate over 2,000 refugees. And they sailed across the Atlantic to Chile. And they ended up settling in Valparaíso, Chile. And if you think about that, there's some similarities also that you hear escaping Nazi Germany or you know, other people that were being attacked or encroached on, really, for lack of a better phrase or description, by Hitler's forces, right? It sounds very familiar. These things keep repeating themselves.
Yes. It's going on today. We have refugees wanting to come to the United States from South America by way of Mexico. We have refugees in the Middle East in various places trying to go into Europe. It feels like we are repeating all the same mistakes.
You know, and we have now a new, well, not such a new crisis, but a really, like, front page news in what's happening with Syria and Turkey and Russia.
Yes.
There's a huge humanitarian crisis from, you know, refugees that had fled into Turkey. And there's a big mess over there right now with respect to how to handle that and forces not adhering to the treaties that they signed, the peace treaties that they signed, or the ceasefires that they signed. So this is a similar thing that we see all over the world, not just Spain or not just the United States or not just Syria, Turkey.
Yeah.
You know, we see these things keep repeating themselves. But we go back to expression, and we need to keep these stories alive, and that's why we write poetry. That's why we write stories.
Exactly.
That's why we write songs. like you sang that Hotel California. It's like when you hear it a cappella and you really listen to the lyrics.
Yes.
You know, they're saying something very powerful. Mm.
Well, thank you. Yeah,
you're welcome.
Well, Sheena, we have about 2.5 more minutes. Is there anything that you would like to tell our listeners, hey, go to such and such website, or go listen to this, or, the floor is open for you.
Oh, thank you very much. I might want to just end with a poem. I wrote a poem called Galapagosian Lament, and since I mentioned Chile and Neruda taking those refugees to Chile, the Galapagos Islands, of course, are off the coast of Chile,
yes.
And there's a, you know, the islands are very mysterious. You don't have any human interference. Well, for a long time. Now there's a little bit of tourism there, right?
Yeah.
But it's a very short poem. Maybe I can write about that. And
that sounds wonderful. Thank you.
Talk about that.
And thank you so much.
Thank you. This is Galapagosian Lament. Sweet bird song of morning, sound unchanged since the launching of time, when birds at Galapagos spread their wings in melodious triumph, and no human encroached to perceive this beauty. Bird song an absolute in man's world, since the viral urban sprawl birthed contemporary destruction, disaffecting winged creatures, resilient, that still sing in helpless lament. Thank you. That's it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
So I would really like to just end by saying, you know, we have to keep these stories alive with poetry and with art so that we don't forget these things, the good or the bad. It's such an important expression of who we are and what we stand for as human beings. And I appreciate that you offer this platform to do that, Chuck. Thank you.
Well, I really appreciate having you on the show, Sheena. And I really hope that I'll be able to see you at a live event here in South Florida one of these months soon. I certainly enjoyed the last one when I met you.
Thank you.
All right.
Stay tuned for that.
All right. Thank you. And it's time for our station break. Our next guest of the evening is Philip Ferrugio. Philip joins me as the co-host of this second segment each week, and I'm going to add him into the show right about now, and he's going to do his column, It's the Umpire, Stupid. So here we go. We're calling up Phil right now, and...
Hello.
Hello, Philip. You are on the air. Let's hear that column.
Yeah, Dancing with the Beast. You know, it's funny, Chuck, and Oliver Stone's brilliant film, Nick Nixon, there is one scene that underlines the whole prism of this military-industrial empire. In this scene, we see thousands of young Americans camping out at the Lincoln Memorial to protest the Vietnam War. Nixon cannot sleep, and actually gets his valet to drive him over to the memorial. He then begins to engage some of the students in conversation, using his knowledge of college football to disarm them. It fails. One young woman confronts him on the war. Nixon, using his previous skills as a college debater, begins a mini monologue on the current situation. Suddenly, the young woman interrupts him, saying, "You can't stop it even if you wanted to." Nixon then explains how this entire system that we live under is like a beast that has a life of its own. Even as president, he can only attempt to control it, this beast. Well, since World War II, our nation has lived under the auspices of this military-industrial empire and its beast. Every single president has worked for this beast in one way or another, regardless of being a Republican or Democrat. Imperialism is our national tonic, and all who serve this empire drink it. That goes for politicians and mainstream media members of all stripes. Even many academics still carry the water for this beast, regardless of calling themselves conservative or liberal or progressive. Look at C-SPAN for a minute. Brian Lamb, its founder, worked for the Nixon White House. He appears to be so grandfatherly and open-minded, but in reality, C-SPAN makes sure that true anti-imperialists and true socialists rarely are seen or covered. When they are covered, it is either late at night or on a Sunday early morning. Recently, C-SPAN covered a class lecture by Professor Margaret O'Mara of the University of Washington on the 1968 political year. She explains to her students how we were fighting in Vietnam to, quote, stop a communist insurgency orchestrated by the Soviet Union and Red China. Never did she explain to the students that this was really a civil war, since Vietnam was originally one nation divided by the colonial French with U.S. aid. Never did she raise the question of what right our country have to even be involved there in the first place. Now, doesn't this echo what happened in 2003 regarding Iraq? What right do we have in attacking another sovereign nation and then occupying it? This writer recalls the almost obscene cheerleading by our entire mainstream media as we carpet bomb Baghdad. We have little Katie Couric of NBC yelling out her famous Marines Rock to millions of viewers. We have Lester Holt of MSNBC, owned by the defense contractor General Electric, describing the invasion force on steroids as if it was the Normandy landings on D-Day. Of course, a few years later, good old Lester got his promotion to evening news anchor and host of one of the 2016 presidential debates. This writer recalls one C-SPAN show soon after 9/11 when they had Professor Alan Dershowitz as a guest. Good old Alan actually was lobbying for a national identity card. After he was off air, this writer called into the show and actually got on. I said that Dershowitz's ancestors and their friends, some of whom may have been burned in the Holocaust flames, would now be turning over in their graves. I then added, using a German accent, "Are you visiting Germany or are you staying here?" And with that, the host cut me off. Dear Alan, who serves the beast so well, disguises himself as a liberal as he defends 90% of what Israel does and never once will speak out against U.S. imperialist wars and occupations. He hides behind debating the Constitution whenever it serves him or the beast, and he gets his books published and makes a small fortune. His newest book, with the joke of a title, The Case Against Impeaching Trump, is another attempt to circumvent the real reasons why Trump is so dangerous to all of us working stiffs. I mean, people like Dershowitz, who's a mega millionaire, will never contradict the free market and the right to earn mega bucks while so many of us are two or three paychecks from being out on the street. So, folks, as long as many working stiffs continue to drink this empire's Kool-Aid, the beast will ask them to dance until death do they part. Thank you.
Well, Phil, that certainly gives us a lot to talk about. Wow.
Go ahead. Start talking.
Okay. Well, all
I'm
right.
I'm ready for question round.
Let me start.
I'm ready for the question round.
All right. Here we go. Let me start with the national identity card. That sounds a lot like something that might have happened in Nazi Germany. And it seems to be actually gaining favor. I mean, there are people who actually propose that everybody needs to get a chip embedded in them so that they can be properly tracked.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny they said about the chip. The guy who was convicted of the Oklahoma City bombing, Timothy McVeigh.
Right.
I think we spoke about this on one of your other shows. But McVeigh claimed, because he was in the Army during the original Desert, whatever they called it, Desert Storm.
Yeah,
back in
the 92. First time. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and he was there. He was in the Army, over in Iraq. And he claims that they had a chip implanted in his ass, on his buttocks, to track him. Among other things, they said it was used to track. Then the Army admitted, the Pentagon admitted that they did put chips on certain soldiers. It was an experimental thing to see if they could track them on the battlefield. Yep. But McVeigh felt that it was more than just a tracking chip.
Well, I bet it probably sends back biometric data, too. This guy's getting excited. Why is that? Okay. All kinds of stuff like that. And I am willing to bet that it's still happening and, in fact, happening a lot more now.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it is. And, that was in 2001 when Dershowitz made that statement, which he should be ashamed of himself. I mean, the man is Jewish. He has ancestors, I think, that were... or relatives, friends of ancestors who were in the Holocaust and died. and to actually talk about a national identity card. I mean, you know, and then, of course, what you said with the chip and reading one's iris, that's another thing that they've been doing a lot. Yeah, yeah. And I remember when back in 95, 96, the bank where I lived in Indianapolis, the bank wanted to get everyone to have a photo ID for the bank, you know, for your bank card.
Huh.
They want to have a photo ID. And there was also talk about doing something with the with some sort of a chip at that time. And the protests were, thank goodness, the protests were so great that they never did have us take a picture to have it put on our the card for the bank, you
right.
know, whatever you want to call it. So that was good. That was a plus. But,
right.
you know, it's scary. It really is, Chuck. It's scary.
It is. Well, you know, for traveling, for people traveling, you know, I believe it's sometime next year the extra restrictions come in. If you don't have the appropriate kind of an ID that can be traced back to your birth certificate and God knows what else, you won't be able to get on a plane or maybe even a train or a bus. I don't know.
And there's a lot of people, I mean, I know even down here in Florida, I know, I think it was my wife was mentioning there was something that came about where she needed to get her birth certificate for something. And she had trouble trying to find one. You know, she's from Michigan, and she never had one. Or she never, because her mother never gave it to her, whatever. And, you know, so what does she do? You know, I mean, the hospital is closed down where she was born. I mean, you know, this is really something else. I mean, this whole thing is so ludicrous, right? Is it ludicrous? I mean, when you admit to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is so ludicrous. I mean, you know, I understand that, you know, but, you know, you have cameras. If you're going to have cameras all over, like in England, they have cameras all over. They have cameras here, too. I know CCTV is important when they're trying to track down a criminal. You know, obviously it is. But
right.
Sometimes you got to worry. You know, you have to worry about, you know, where's the line drawn? You know,
yeah.
Basically,
who determines who the criminals are? You know, because, you know, somebody who is protesting against the government, who is just making some noise about free speech or whatever, like you or me, might be construed as an enemy.
Well, that's what some of these laws were actually passed about, these anti-terrorism laws, and exactly what you said, that in certain instances they can actually arrest someone who's part of a protest, a street protest, if there's certain factors are not met. I mean, they can actually arrest somebody just for being out there protesting in the streets, and that's really scary. And I remember some people I knew, like maybe 15 years ago, were telling me about the demonstrations they had in South Florida against the G7 meeting or something, one of those, you know, international meetings that was held in Miami or
right.
And there was a demonstration, and I remember the chief of police, his name was Timoney, I think he was the ex police chief of Philadelphia. I mean, this guy is a you know, this is a right out of the scripting of a movie. This is far right wing guy, okay?
Hmm.
And he was a police chief in Miami. I believe it was Miami. And I mean, they were using rubber bullets on peaceful street protesters. People were protesting peacefully in the streets.
Yeah.
And they claimed they needed to do crowd control, and they were shooting them with rubber bullets, which are very painful.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people went to the hospital, and then they were beating people up too. I don't know if you heard about that. You
I'm
were living
sure.
down there at the time.
Yeah, I heard about it, but I didn't. I was not, close
right,
enough to hear
right.
about it personally.
Right, but I mean, you have to understand, it's really scary, though.
Yeah, it certainly is. Of course, you know, way back in the 60s or 70s, when we used to do marches on Washington and all that stuff. Hey, my mom got tear gassed in front of the White House.
Yeah, well, that's what they were doing. I mean,
exactly.
And these were peaceful demonstrations. These were peaceful demonstrations.
Exactly.
You know? And now, when she was tear gassed, I mean, they didn't try to go after you, that you were the one that did it, did they? I mean, did you have any trouble with your mom? No, you had no trouble.
No.
I
happened to be at the same demonstration, but I was with a group. Believe it or not, I was with a group from my high school. My high school sent a bus down we all went down to be part of the march, and it was pretty cool. But meanwhile, my uncle and my mom went down on their own, and they were in a different part of it. You know, this was huge. You know, there were like a 500,000 people. And they were over in front of the White House, and they got tear gassed.
You know, there was a documentary, and I'm really sorry if people are listening. I saw it, and I can't think of the name of it, but it's a documentary about the Republican convention that was in Minneapolis. Was that 08 or 012 or 12?
I'm not sure.
And there were big demonstrations, you know, planned for the Republican. And the documentary was covering. There were a bunch of kids in Louisiana that were part of a peace group or some sort of a anarchist type of peace group, and they used to have meetings down there. You know, nothing secretive.
Right.
And there was a guy who did some volunteer work for the people after Hurricane Katrina. This guy, he was a little bit older than these kids, than these college kids.
Uh-huh.
And he got involved with these meetings. And what happened was these two young kids, I don't know where they were from, maybe Texas. They came down, they were in Louisiana, and they wanted to do something to help, you know, change things and to protest the right wing elements in this country.
Right.
And so they were all going to go by bus. They were going to get a charter bus and go up to Minneapolis to participate in some demonstrations outside the convention.
Uh-huh.
And this guy was part of the group, this older guy. He was in his late 20s, I think. And he was older. Well, I mean, these kids were 19, 18.
Yeah, I know. I'm just messing with you. Go ahead.
And he was influencing them. Now, this is serious. He was influencing these two kids to make, you know, Molotov. He showed them how to make Molotov cocktails.
Uh-huh.
And he told them how to use them. He told them how to use them. And he did everything to get these kids ready to go out. And he wanted them to throw one at a police car,
right?
You know, a parked police car, changing
the whole purpose of the demonstration.
Right, but here's the deal. Here's the deal.
Was he working for the FBI?
Yeah, he was an informant, and he was working for the FBI undercover.
Funny how I knew that.
Yeah, but it's a true story, and
I believe it.
Oh,
I know it's true.
He got these two kids, and they did it. The kids made the Molotov cocktails, and they threw them out of the car, and they got arrested for, like, you know, terrorism.
Yeah, of course.
And they went to trial, and it was a horrible story. I don't know if they're still in jail now, but and this son of a bitch, he was one, and then he was seen a year later at a right-wing convention, I don't know where it was, at some hotel. He was a featured speaker.
Yeah.
He was a featured speaker. I think Steve Bannon was the guy that was running this whole convention or whatever you want to call it. And they had this guy as a speaker, all right? And here's the guy that set these two kids up. He set these two kids up.
Yeah.
These two foolish kids. All right? And that's what these people do.
Exactly. Exactly. And it just happens over and over again, Phil. It's
And you know, if things get worse, you know, in this country, which I think they might, you know, economically, if we have a what they're all thinking, it might be some sort of a crash, like a financial crisis again, because it goes in cycles because of this capitalist system. It's already predicated. It's predicated to have these booms and busts.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had the boom. Remember, we had the boom in the early 2000s, you know, the housing, all that stuff. And then in 2008, we had the bust. And that was like 11 years ago. And if there's another one and people are really feeling, you know, being hurt, you know, financially out of work and they can't pay their rents or their mortgages, you know, I think that they're just getting ready. The people in power are just getting ready to have a very strong surveillance and, you know, militaristic presence, knowing that people are going to be angry. And why are they being angry? Because everyone's getting screwed.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
I mean, by the super rich.
I might even go so far, Phil, as to say that the super rich, whoever these people are, the elite, whatever you want to call them, might be actually pushing. Really trying to get us into something that's almost a civil war, just so they can come back and put it down and consolidate, you know, their, you know, the power of the state.
Well, that's why, because I mean, you know me, but maybe a lot of people don't. Now, you know, I'm a socialist. Okay, I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a progressive. I believe in socialism. And it's funny because when you say socialism, 90% of people think it means that the government runs everything. That's not what it means.
No.
I'm a socialist, and I believe very strongly in small business. I think small business is the backbone of this country. So I'm a socialist who believes in small business, but anything too big or anything for the needs of the people should not be owned by private interests. Now, you look at Pacific Gas and Electric. What happened out there with the Paradise, California, with the fires and everything?
Yeah, right.
Pacific Gas and Electric was already—they were already found guilty. They were sued and they lost, okay, because they did not maintain the areas around all their power lines, and they didn't maintain their power lines when the high winds were coming, and that's what caused all these fires. And now they're probably going to go bankrupt. I mean, they're probably going to have to go bankrupt, and yet there is not a large outcry and this is California, is a more progressive state, right? And there's still not a big outcry by the people in the legislature to have the government take over the utilities.
Yeah.
You know, why do we need private interests,
Phil,
running them, you know?
Phil, they're a progressive state, but remember, they gave us Ronald Reagan and Jerry Brown, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And the Terminator.
Yeah.
Yeah, Terminator.
Exactly.
But, you know, when he said, I blow you up, I mean, look what happened with all these fires. It's not even funny. It's sad. But amen. Seriously, there's an instance when the corporate greed, okay, my brother lives out there, and he's been following this really closely. And these companies for years were making profits, you know, PG&E, and they were giving their executives raises and bonuses, and they weren't using enough of their money to make the areas around the power lines safe, you know, and groomed, you know, the grass cut and the power lines, the power, you know, whatever you want to call them, make sure that everything, all the towers, they didn't do a good job, okay, for years. And now look what happened. So here's my question to you. Why do we need private banks? That's the biggest thing. Why do we need private utilities, you know? But why do we need private banking? I mean, think about it, Chuck. What is it? Does a bank make a bagel or a loaf of bread or do they? No, it's a service. That's all it is. You know, you put your money in the bank and they hold it for you. You have a checking account, or if you need a loan for a business or something, why do we need a private enterprise to do that? Okay, the local community can run their own bank, you know. And it would be a lot cheaper. It'd be a lot cheaper because it wouldn't be any real profit, you know? So these are things that, you know, we need to understand that it's all tied into this empire, Chuck. That's my whole point.
It certainly is.
The point of my piece Yeah, it's a beast. The umpire is a beast, as
Nixon
said it. He said it. I didn't say it. He said, well, it's like a beast. It has a life of its own. He said that.
Yeah.
He understood. He knew.
He did.
He knew the beast, and the beast got rid of him.
Yep.
The beast got rid of him.
He was actually smarter than we give him credit for, but we're just about out of time. I'm going to leave you with one thought here, Phil. There is a show called Goliath on Amazon Prime, and there's a lot going on in that show. It has to do with the water rights for various places and how people are stealing the water from other people. But it's like it's very realistic, and you really should check it out.
Let me just say this quickly. Water is going to be the next oil. Okay, that's number one.
Yeah.
Drinking water. Drinking water is going to be the next oil. And after that, you know what's going to be? The next oil is going to be fresh air.
Yeah. Very much
I'm
so.
I'm serious.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you, Philip. I really appreciate having you as my co-host on this segment of the show every week. And I look forward to the next time.
And people can go to Global Research website.
Hey,
Global Research
people
website
can go
to
get
all my articles.
People can go to itstheempirestupid.com.
That's right. We have a new website at Chuck.
That's right.
It's theempirestupid.com. Folks, check it out.
Check it out. Thank you, Phil.
Take care.
All right. Well, all right. We are back for our second hour of the New American Dream Radio Show, and I want to remind everyone, it's listener-supported radio. Revolution Radio brings you two streams of shows pretty much 24/7. Head on over to revolution.radio or freedomslips.com and make sure that you help them out, because it's a great cause. All right, now, here we go. I'm going to bring up a conversation I had earlier in the day with Frank Cordero of the Des Moines Catholic Worker. So here we go.
Hello, Chuck.
Hello, Frank. Can you hear me this time?
I can. Something must have went wrong the first time.
Yes, yeah. Indeed.
So this is an early call. Do you want to do it now?
Yeah, if you can.
Sure. Let's jump right into it. There is no nothing new to say on the Jess and Ruby front. There's officially no comment on this end of the on my end, because that's my instruction. So that I say to begin with, when we can say something and know something, we'll let you know.
Okay. Well,
the work that's going on for me anyway is we're trying to pull together our November December issue of the Via Pacis, which is our last issue of the year, and it's always the beg issue. So we got to beg for money. And for the last 15 years, I've been writing a front page beg letter. It's like a routine kind of spiritual yearly accountability assessment about our work and our cash needs. So, what we need for our four houses and the work we do, money wise, is 75 grand a year. Uh-huh. You know, that sounds like a lot of money until you measure what gets
houses?
Done.
That's not four much houses. For four houses. Wow.
No.
No.
Four
no.
houses, you pay all the monthly bills, the taxes, then you have 8 to 20 people in these houses. They get room and board. No one's paid a salary. We beg all the stuff we need. Food, housing, clothing, everything. We rarely buy stuff. And we serve 9 meals from our first floor 5 days a week.
Uh-huh.
We're open a total of 18 hours. We see 50 to 100 people each day that we're open. So we're dealing with well over 500 meals a week. We have two vans. So we got to buy insurance and gas for those two, and they're old. It's a 75 grand operation, which really means that we have hundreds upon hundreds of volunteer hours tons and tons of just stuff we beg, beginning with food.
Wow.
So it's a labor intense operation. It's cash. The cash needed is minimal. One of my lines says that nobody does it cheaper. No, not church, not state, not social services, professional people. You just don't do it. So that's the pitch. And then I'll say, it's really not a lot of money unless we can't pay the bills.
Then it is a lot of money. And then it gets to be a lot of money. Yeah, I understand.
So that's when we tell people, that's why we need your help. You heard my best lines. That's part of the onset that I go through. It's a good thing for me just to remind myself and the readers what we actually do. The work we do. So that's one thing we're doing. Then the other thing is that I'm let's see. I got a, you know who's calling me right now?
Who?
Richard Flamer.
Oh, really?
He's at the vets. He and Araceli are with us right now. He's got some medical stuff he's doing. And Araceli may well stay with us up to a year because she's got to be up here trying to get her green card. All of these things are happening. And he was trying to call because I got to pick him up at the vet's hospital. He just had some kind of a surgery or something.
Well, you know what? Yeah. You know what? He's on the show tonight too. I need to call him.
So a preview. Just to remind him, ask him how he is and how well he is. And is it raining in Des Moines? That's great.
That's the way
it works. So maybe I should cut this a little short to go pick him up.
We don't want him to be stuck out there. But
no,
thank you, Frank, for I always enjoy the chance to visit with you each week. And hey, we'll do it again next time.
Thank you, Chuck. God bless, and I'm on my way to pick up Flamer.
All right.
So he can be on your show tonight. All right.
Okay. We'll see ya. Sounds great. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, folks, as it happens, I did get to talk to Richard Flamer a little bit later. Richard normally joins us from Chiapas in Mexico, but hey, this month he's in Des Moines. So I'm going to play you the conversation that I had with Richard Flamer. This is actually kind of a composite, because the quality, was going down, so I had to, splice a couple pieces together, but I think you will enjoy it, and here we go!
Chuck.
Well, hello, Richard.
How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm fine. Araceli and I made it up to Des Moines, and had several appointments with an immigration lawyer trying to get her residency and a green card.
Right. Okay.
And so it looks like she's going to have to stay here for 6 months to a year while all that gets processed.
Right.
But I'm going to head back down. I got to find the truck, and I already got tours waiting for me, so I got a month to figure that out. I'll figure something out.
I'm sure you will. You always seem to. Frank said I should ask you if it was raining in Des Moines and how you were feeling today.
I'm okay. I had a little cyst that the surgeon opened up and cleaned up, and it's on my butt, so it's tough sitting around, but other than that, I'm fine.
That's rough if you can't sit down.
The VA's been really good. I mean, hospital here is just wonderful. The folks have been really great. So they're getting new glasses and new shoes and stuff like that.
Okay.
So, and I got my meds, and the doctor looks at me and says, "For an old man, you're in good shape."
All right then.
Yeah. Anyway, I spent quite a bit of time these last few weeks thinking about Francisco Toledo.
Oh.
I'll explain in a few minutes. He's an artist from Mexico, and he's had a great influence on not just me, but all kinds of young Mexican artists, and trying to preserve this Zapotec culture and he's the only artist my in-laws know anything about. This is also a Zapotec Indian.
Huh.
Really interesting. Anyway, so I thought I'd talk about him tonight.
Okay. Sounds good.
You ready to go?
Yeah, just keep going. I'm recording. I'm keeping all this.
Francisco Toledo. Imagine an old man with wispy, scraggly beard and hair dressed in the white shirt and pants of a Mexican peasant running down a village street with sandals flapping, tugging on the string of a kite he made, and decorated with a portrait of one of the students from Ayotzinapa, disappeared 5 years ago. A photograph taken on that day was by Jorge Arturo Perez Alonso. In the dusty street, Francisco Toledo, like a Pied Piper, is followed by young children. This old man, not just an artist, was a philanthropist of great heart and action. His paintings, many of which have sold for six figures in the U.S., in England, in Germany, in Spain. He never forgot where he came from, Juchitán de Zaragoza. It's a farm town in the heart of Oaxacan life, with a great part of the population still speaking Zapoteco or Miche. From his first exhibition at age 19 in Fort Worth, Texas, he was an internationalist. He went to Mexico City for his art school, but left when he felt the teachers could not teach him more than the technical. Furthermore, he went to Paris, where he was helped by the poet Octavio Paz and supported with the help of Rufino Tamayo, where he learned his graphic arts in the famous taller of Stanley William Hayter. He was at the center of artists who included Paul Klee, Pierre Alechinsky, Pablo Picasso, etc. In Paris, he discovered a greater sense of color, while his subject continued to be based in the natural world, with his Oaxaca, where his shoemaker father used to take him hunting. In the 1980s, his success was obvious. He began to buy historic buildings in the center of Oaxaca City, where he rebuilt those magnificent colonial structures to form a center of culture. IAGO, or the Institute of Graphic Arts of Oaxaca, was the first, which served as not only a workshop for etching and engraving, but formed a library of thousands of books on art. A superb small exhibition was started with exhibits of the growing collection of prints by Rufino Picasso, Giorgio Di Chirico, Goya, and Jose Guadalupe Posada. Near the same time, the Manuel Alvarez Bravo Photographic Center and the Art Center of San Agustin, which functioned as a working center for younger artists, including young people who had been awarded scholarships to come and work with the master, began to function. The library, the exhibition center, and the design center hosted various workshops and lectures, all open to the public. Since those early years, he initiated a library of videos and movies with an annual prize given for works in indigenous languages. He started a film festival and, with the aid of several wealthy families who were patrons of his art, started an additional three large libraries, one in Juchitán, his hometown, another in Oaxaca City, and the third, a library for the blind with thousands of texts in Braille. As an activist, he is famous in Mexico for his happenings, probably the most famous being his action regarding the announcement that McDonald's was set to build a restaurant in the historic center of Oaxaca City. He called for a massive demonstration in the center of town where he announced he would disrobe at 70 years old if he didn't have enough support. He paid for 2,000 tamales, which were passed out along the signs reading Tamales C, Hamburguesas, all. His event was successful with all 2,000 tamales given away. The city officials backed down and refused permission for the McDonald's to build in the center of town. When a transnational hotel threatened to build a 12-story hotel in the same city center, through his contacts with the rich, he was able to buy the land, turn it into a community garden, which eventually became home to the majority of native plants of Oaxaca. It's now a research facility. He wasn't always successful at his efforts to combat the issues which affected his native land, but he was never combative about his struggles. On several occasions, he was asked about his failed efforts, and his only response was to cry. In 2017, when a devastating earthquake rocked Oaxaca and Chiapas 10 days before the earthquake in Mexico City, later when his family started portable kitchens in and around Juchitán, 40 kitchens were installed within 3 days. Kitchens were manned 24 hours a day, continuing for 60 days until the Army took over the units. To give one an idea of the enormity of the operation, over 45,000 tortillas, 6,000 chickens, 3,000 kilos of coffee were required daily, that is, per day. Everyone who asked was given food, the workers, the poor, the homeless. Kitchens were staffed by Native women, all who were paid out of the coffers of the Toledo family. During all his civic work, he continued to produce his art. His surrealistic images of turtles, scarabs, foxes, frogs, iguanas, ants, crabs, tarantulas, alligators, and boas. The descriptive catalog of his work picks up 4 volumes describing over 9,000 works. With the aid of Alfred Harp Helou and the Carlos Slim Foundation, he was able to help in the purchase of various incunabula, these manuscripts made before the invention of printing, for the National Library. With the same group, he helped start an academy of baseball, where he was occasionally found hitting pitches in his turn at bat. Prolific is an understatement when one speaks of his art. Textiles, working with the famous weavers of Oaxaca, etchings and engravings in the tradition of Durer, Piranesi, and Picasso. Watercolors, oils, and sculptures reminiscent of Paul Klee. They are all made in his unique style. His family is as diverse as his art. The eldest daughter, Natalia Toledo Paz, is a superb poet, now a subsecretary of the National Arts Endowment. Another daughter is an administrator for his various nonprofit groups, while one of his sons is a tattoo artist. His last wife, a potter and textile worker, is from Denmark, who has explored various techniques, some with the designs of the master, others of her own creations. By 2014, 43 students from the Teachers College in Ayotzinapa were disappeared. A subsequent government cover-up managed to arrest over 45 people with few real answers. 24 of those arrested have been released from custody by the efforts of the National Human Rights Commission, because their confessions were obtained under torture. The parents of the 43, along with many in the civil society, have continued to march, protest, and seek answers to the disappearance. Toledo's response was to paint the 43 portraits on pipes and have his artist friends flying them in the historic district of Oaxaca. As an aside, the weekend after Toledo's death, in lieu of a public memorial service, a giant celebration was held in the center of Mexico City, where the Arts Endowment set up booths staffed by young people who built kites. Many of the young people, as artists, not only helped build the kites, but helped in decorating the same. Hundreds of kites were flown in the afternoon and late evening. As fame came along, Francisco Toledo tried to stay out of the light. He very rarely met with journalists or, practically speaking, only with other artists. Was rarely seen by the outside world. In fact, sending his wife and daughter to the various openings of his exhibitions, whether they were in Mexico or abroad. He rarely has had himself photographed. Elusive would best describe him. He's a great example of how writers and artists should respond, letting their words speak for them with greater eloquence. This work is known for its portrayal of flora and fauna, mythical imagery, and erotic content. Art critic Dory Ashton characterized Toledo as a modern artist who, like others such as Paul Klee, Marc Chagall, and Miró, has learned the value of the sweeping glance into the minutest corners of nature. I first heard of Toledo when I was a used book dealer in Omaha, Nebraska. I had studied and made a few efforts at printing books by hand. Along the way, I helped make paper, designed various posters, and bought and sold small works of art. I discovered several books illustrated by the master. I was instantly amazed. Though I didn't have enough Spanish to read the books at Prebos, I was delighted with the overall design, the illustrations, and ingenuity of the illustrator. In the U.S., much is made of art in some circles. To be an illustrator, to many, is to be a minor artist. But I had discovered a major artist in these books, sort of like the way I discovered William Blake. Just like Toledo when he was young, I found the art incredible, though I didn't understand much of the poetry. When I started wandering Central America and Mexico, the works of Toledo took on even greater significance. An artist and an activist, a man who craved the preservation of his ancient culture in new and different ways. Living in Mexico these last 20 years has only reinforced that position. The man, Francisco Toledo, is what I think of as a prophet for our time, living the famous dictum of Dostoevsky, that beauty will save the world. Did you like it?
Very much. Thank you, Richard. Always good. Appreciate you.
You bet.
Have a good. How long are you going to be up in the Des Moines area?
I'll be in Des Moines and Omaha for the next roughly month.
Okay.
I'll be back down first part of November, first week or so in November.
Okay, so probably the next time I talk to you, you'll be in Chiapas. And so have a very good and safe trip. Okay.
Thanks, Chuck.
Thank you, Richard. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
You too. I'm so lucky to have the guests that I have. Thank you, Sheena Palazzuri and Richard Flamer. And coming up in the next half hour, we'll have... let me thank you, Philip Ferruggio. And coming up in the next half hour, we'll have Frank Cordero. And that was this one. Now, coming up the next half hour, we're going to have Thomas Wortman, and ignore my little glitches there. And I'm going to sing a song to get us out of this section. And here we go. The eastern wood, it is exploding. Violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war. What's that gun you're toting? Even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears that I'm feeling today? If the button's pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. My blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation. Marches alone can't bring integration. What human respect is disintegrating. The whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Talk to you on the other side of the station break. Thank you. Well, all right, everybody. Things are going very fast, and we are down to the last half-hour segment of our program. Let me remind you, this is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, and it's listener-supported radio. So you make sure you head on over there, revolution.radio or freedomslips.com. There are some very cool products to buy, and if you just want to donate, well, there's a donate button too. So you just head on over there, show them some love. That's what we need. All right. Now, our next guest of the evening is Thomas Wertmann, and I'm going to bring him on to the show right about now. Thomas runs MUFON. That's a mutual UFO network, I think. Anyway, it's a UFO group in Ohio, and he is in charge of it, and we are going to get him on the show right about now. Hello, Thomas. It's Chuck Gregory, the New American Dream Radio Show, and you are on the air.
Great, Chuck. And last month, one of the big stories was the videos that surfaced back in 2017 involving UFO events from 2004 and 2014 to 15 involving naval personnel, in this case, air crews. The Navy admitted that in these videos that they don't know what these objects are. They're kind of being classified not as UFOs, but they're calling them UAPs for a new name, unidentified aerial phenomena. But these things have gone public. And one of the individuals involved with the story on there goes back to the 2004 event. His name is David Fravor. He was the commander of a group called the Black Aces. He had 24 years in the military, 18 years in the Navy. Matter of fact, he was in Top Gun, had experience in Desert Storm. So he was a very experienced pilot. Well, he's been one of the more vocal ones involving this whole thing. Well, Fravor made a comment the other day that he knows roughly about 60 to 70 pilots who've seen UFOs while flying. Now, that's a pretty high number, Chuck, 60 to 70 pilots who have seen UFOs while flying. And what I want to do is not focus initially on Fravor's experience right now, but I want to take and jump to one of the stories that he brought out the other day from one of his, what he calls buds. They've got a network of pilots who talk to each other. He's got a number of friends who are former Navy pilots. And he brought out a story the other day from one of his friends. He does one of my buds. He said one of my buds back in the 1990s, his job was to basically fetch aerial targeting drones. What they would do is they'd launch these drones off of naval ships. The drones would fly out X number of miles using for targeting exercises. Then parachutes would deploy and these targets would descend down into the ocean. Well, his bud, as he called it, was a pilot on a CH-53 helicopter, which is one of those heavy lift helicopters used by the Marines. At the time, they're off the East Coast, roughly down around the Puerto Rico area. And he said that one of these drones was launched out. It descended in the ocean. They went out to recover it. And on the helicopter, he could actually look down by his feet and actually see through like windows down to the ocean. So here they get over the site. They're roughly about 50 feet over the location where this targeting drone is at. And they drop the diver down to recover this object. What they would do is they would take and hook onto the drone and pull it back out of the water. Was they're hovering 50 feet above the water. He says the diver's down there hooking on, and he sees this large black mass coming from the depths of the ocean. He said the ocean was clear. And you could see this thing coming up. He said it was roughly circular shape. It started rising up. Well, they recovered the diver. They recovered the drone. And this thing rose up, not breaking the surface, but distinctly enough that he could see that this large black image was just right below the water's surface. Well, once they got the drone out of the water, whatever this was descended back down into the ocean. Well, they didn't know what it was. Well, it's one thing, Chuck, to see this thing, something like this, once. But to see it twice, that's another thing. As Fravor said, his bud said, a few months later, they're out on another exercise. In this case, instead of recovering a targeting drone that was launching the ship, they're actually recovering a torpedo. This torpedo was launched out, and it was collecting data that they would use later on. Well, this torpedo was launched. Same thing. The CH-33 or 53 helicopter goes out to recover it. They get over to site, and as they're starting to get ready to prepare to pick this thing up, he said, here they're hovering, and his buddy looks down through the windows. The diver is going down on the hook, basically on the winch system. And right when he's getting just a few feet above the water, his bud sees this large, black, circular-shaped object coming up from the depths of the ocean again slowly. And he says, you can tell it's not a submarine. He says, he's seen some of a submarine. We call that, and he said, it was definitely not a submarine. Well, he started screaming to get this diver up now because he didn't know what was going to happen. So they started winching the diver back up. The diver has no clue what's going on. He's, you know, looking around totally befuddled. They get him back up, and right as they start raising him up, the next thing you know, this torpedo starts sinking below the surface and disappears. And they lose the torpedo. Fortunately, they didn't lose the diver. Now, what it was, he has no clue. But it was this large, circular-shaped object that appeared to basically take this torpedo back down below the surface and disappear with it. Who knows what it was? He said it wasn't a submarine. I mean, different ones could argue maybe it was a whale. Who knows? Maybe it's Godzilla, for all I know, Chuck, you know. But the thing is here's a event, again, by naval personnel. Now, the thing I was always wondering was, would they have cameras on board at this time? When they filmed the earlier encounters, they had cameras on board the F-18 fighters. Huh. I'm thinking if they're doing training exercises, wouldn't you think that they would have had cameras also on board these helicopters?
You'd think so.
Documenting the training exercise. Yeah, verifying that, okay, are they doing everything to Hoyle? And you would think that they would have had video of these things coming up. I'm just wondering if these videos are just kind of hiding in some vault out there waiting to come back to the surface, so to speak. So this is another story, and this actually was known back in 2017 when the story broke about what they called glowing auras, which involved the Navy reports back in 2017, the end of 2017. The reporters knew about these stories. Fravor told them about them, but for some reason they held out on them. Huh. They didn't publish these. But now we go back to Fravor's story. And Fravor, when he was involved with his event back in 2004, he was very vocal about this again the other day, describing the whole event. He said he was actually out doing training exercises himself that day off of California. And when he went out, they were just doing a basic mission. They were told that they had a real-world target, which meant that, okay, you're going to be pulled away from your normal training exercise. We want you to investigate something. Now, they thought it could be drug runners coming up maybe along the coast. They were also asked if they had any ordnance on board, which they didn't. Ordnance meaning, do you have any weapons? Right. And he said it was highly unusual that they would ever have anything like that off the coast of California. But they went out to investigate. And when he was sent out to the target, first of all, he was never told it for 2 weeks, he said, around the time of his event, that they'd been seeing objects in that same area, just going from 80,000 feet down to 20,000 feet and disappearing off the screens. He didn't know that whatsoever, and he said he was actually kind of upset that he was never informed that this was going to be happening. So they went out, they got close to the location. They had almost like a countdown, like you're 30 miles away, 20 miles away. And once it got to the targeting area where this object was at, that they picked up on radar, and it was picked up on radar by the Princeton. And the reason that the Princeton sent them out there is because they'd had all these eyes for 2 weeks. They wanted to really kind of find out what this was, because there was concern that this could be a potential accident-type situation with military jets and other military craft in the region. Once he got to the location, he didn't pick up anything on his radar, but he searched the track. Well, he took and saw a disturbance on the water. Now, this goes back to, like, the earlier story started with. He sees what appears to be disturbance on the water, which they think is potentially a commercial airliner that's crashed. So he's at 20,000 feet. He starts going down to investigate. His wing person stays at 20,000 feet. He does a circular motion descending down. The object, he said he can see, basically going back and forth extremely rapid. And it wasn't making a motion. He thought initially like a helicopter. I mean, you think of a helicopter with rotors, you could see a disturbance on the water. He said it almost had a disturbance, something like that. Well, he said the object was also kind of like darting back and forth. And he said the motions it was making were not consistent with like a helicopter or any kind of craft like that. It was too instantaneous. It was too rapid, a motion back and forth. Well, then this object raised up, appeared to basically see him, and started basically doing a reverse of his motion. He's descending in a circular motion going down. It started going up in a circular motion. As he cut across the circle to intersect it, he said the thing shot off in basically 1 second and disappeared.
Whoa.
Now, the important thing about this story is you had not only verification from his altitude, which was roughly 12,000 feet, you had verification from his wing person, who was at 20,000 feet, two fully different angles of the object disappearing. He said visibility is 50 miles. Now, an SR-71 Blackbird, which is basically in mothballs right now, was one of our fastest planes. You're talking basically Mach 3. He said even an aircraft traveling like at Mach 3, we would have seen that for about 1 minute going out. We would have had that much visibility. Wow. He said this thing was basically gone in a second, disappeared.
Whoa.
Yeah. And what happened next is he went to go back to a ready point. As he starts to go back to a ready point, since he lost sight of the object, he was notified by the guided missile cruiser Princeton that here that object was at his ready point 60 miles away in less than 1 minute.
Huh.
So the speed of that thing, Chuck, had to be incredible, whatever it was.
Really?
So this is what's now prompted the change in the Navy guidelines and reporting. They want more information on UFOs because they don't know what they're out there with. They want to find out what these things are. Are they ours? Nobody's admitting it on our side. Are they somebody else's, let's say, a foreign country? Nobody's saying that either. But they definitely want to find it out. So Fravor's been very, very vocal. He also brought up events involving some other people who he did name off the coast of North Carolina, Florida. And he also clarified something in my mind of the three videos that were released, and they weren't released officially. What happened is, the way it sounds, there is a clearance given for internal use on these three videos within, like, the Defense Department.
Huh.
But they got released through the New York Times. And once they went public, they couldn't back down, and they couldn't say, okay, forget all this.
Huh.
It was too late. They're out in the public. Well, of the three videos, there was one called Gimbal, which refers to the FLIR cameras. One, the FLIR camera could rotate. Another one was called Non-Gimbal, if your listeners wanted to check these out.
Hmm.
The Non-Gimbal video was one which doesn't rotate. The flight after Fravor's, he was not equipped with FLIR. The later flight was, because he told his other pilots and his crew. They said, hey, you know, basically we need a FLIR pod on there. Let's see what we can track. They were able to track the object. And the object at the very end of the video you see shooting off to the left. He said, well, I don't know how fast it was moving, but that was faster than a conventional aircraft zipping off out of view.
Hmm.
Also in the video, you see them targeting, basically locking on to one jet. But when you hear the description, they're saying that there's a whole fleet of them. What he described is they have the capability basically of locking on to one of the objects with the FLIR camera. But their radar can also be tracking other objects. And they said basically five objects that the radar was tracking. The FLIR was picking up one object, but the radar was picking up more than that, a group of roughly five. So they all appeared to be traveling almost like in unison and moving in unison. So you've got this much bigger story. And he added, and I've heard before, that as he was describing the video, he made a comment that the radar, there was an attempt to jam the radar so they couldn't track it.
Huh.
So basically what it was saying that this was a active attempt to jam the radar.
Really?
Now, to me, if you're going to be jamming radar, Chuck, I don't know. Tell me if this makes sense or not. But you would have to know, first of all, you're being tracked by radar.
Yeah, right.
So if you know you're being tracked by radar, then they're doing something to definitely try to, you know, jam it.
Hmm.
Now, you've also got other methods of kind of like stealth, like what we have for stealth, basically our stealth fighters or stealth bombers, which is the design of the aircraft itself, tries to minimize the radar signal. But this was almost like a, I don't want to say electronic, but it was appeared to be an attempt to jam the radar.
Really?
So you've got a lot going on at this whole event that keeps coming out, and there's like more to the story every day.
Hmm.
Now, this Fravor to me seems extremely believable. But he was actually even joking. He says, I'm not going to say that sometimes Navy pilots don't also create UFOs intentionally. He was saying back in the day, he used to joke around when they had these headsets that were night vision.
Right.
He said at the time they would fly with night vision headsets with these fighters. So he's out flying out over like the desert. And he goes in the desert, he says, if these night vision things, he says, you could see out like 20, 30 miles and see a campfire. Now think about that, 30 miles out and see a campfire.
Yeah, right.
So he says, we know somebody's camping out there. So we're like, okay, let's have fun, you know?
Huh.
So they fly in such a way that they kind of come flying in, they back the engines off so nobody can hear the engines. And right when they get over the campfire, he says you basically put the plane into a climb, you hit the afterburners, and next thing you know, here they're seeing a UFO.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
He says, I'm not smart enough to figure this out myself. He says other guys were doing it.
Hmm.
But in this case, this is not what was being done.
Mm-hmm.
He said this craft and the two other videos, by the way, the first video was off the West Coast. The two other videos called the Gimbal and Go Fast, as it was termed. He said those were off the coast of the East Coast is when they
really?
Were taken roughly around the 2014-2015 period. So he clarified that. So and he also knew some of the pilots that were involved over on the East Coast. And one of the encounters, and this is what led to the Navy also wanting to change the guidelines. He said one of the objects basically came towards the aircraft and went between two aircraft who were flying in tandem and passed within about 100 feet of the wing of one of the aircraft. Now, this is why they heightened, getting information, because if you don't know what's coming at you, and it's about 100 feet away, and you're going in opposite directions, that could be a potential collision, and they definitely want to find out what these things are.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it still could go back as something that we don't know that we have, because they're always testing technologies, like you know, that's well in advance in the future
right.
out there. They're testing things in different areas. But this is one of the really, really good stories right now.
Hmm.
And I'm going to keep trying to dig more stuff out on this to see what I can find.
Well, I will be very interested to hear what you come up with, Thomas. This is it's some weird stuff going on.
Oh, definitely. Without a doubt on it, Chuck. Without a doubt. And there's been some other things more recent that's come out, not from the Navy, but in this case from private news down in the region. And sometimes I wonder if some of these stories don't come out just because of, you know, these other stories making the major headlines with the military. There was one that some videos started going viral off the coast of North Carolina where you see about a dozen or so lights coming down and drifting down over the water. And I went back and started researching that one myself with the information. I got a hold of the video, looked at the video, identified as close as I could where the individual was at taking the video. He was actually on a ferry going, as he called it, off of North Carolina. It was actually between the Outer Banks of North Carolina and the coast of North Carolina itself. He was on a ferry heading back towards land when he filmed these objects hovering over the water. And what I did is I went back in and first of all started eliminating the known. And there's actually a military operation area in that region. And when I went back and just started digging deeper, I was able to identify an area in the proximity where he was at that they had sunk some freighters, and the Navy was actually using these for targeting. The Navy and also other branches were using these for targeting exercises. And it appears that what they were doing is dropping flares as an exercise in that region. There are also some other individuals out there who were stationed at the base who confirmed that, yeah, this is, by looking at the videos, this is our flares descending. This is a typical exercise. But this video going viral, and I think it was just attracting attention based on some of the military stuff coming out in the last couple of years. But that was something more recent. So that's where we're at, Chuck.
Well, that is pretty cool, Thomas. Thank you so much for keeping us up to date on what's going on. I really appreciate having you on the show every month.
Oh, I appreciate being on the show every month. It's a great time.
Well,
and I was.
Go ahead.
And I was digging out a couple other things too. Matter of fact, in case you want to check out some UFOs. Supposedly in Bangkok, out of Thailand, now that if you want to mark it off your bucket list, there's supposedly a place over there where individuals are getting together now that are meditating on top of this mountain, and they're actually meditating, and they're talking to aliens. And this is where you go out a little bit more left field. They're talking to aliens from Pluto and also some other planet in the Milky Way.
Really?
What they do is they meet over there. Yeah, what they do is they meet over there by this Buddhist temple. And they meet by this temple out in the middle of basically like it's some sort of a sugarcane field or something like that over there. They get together. They meditate. And they've been able to basically summon these individuals who are described as silvery aliens. And they talked to him, and they said, just so that you know, that there's going to be World War III breaking out in 2022. And if it does break out, you may be one of the lucky survivors, Chuck.
Oh, yeah?
They can help through the situation. Yeah.
That seems unlikely for anybody in South Florida to be a survivor of World War III, but I don't know.
I don't know. But that's what they're saying today, you know, a few of the lucky survivors, they're going to help get through the whole event out here. And the government over there hasn't really taken kindly, and the Forestry Service, because they said, here these people are going up to the holy sites, which they're not supposed to, and really kind of contaminating protected areas, because these are all protected forest up in there.
Wow.
With their camping exercises. And they said, you know, if they catch anybody doing any wrongdoing, they're going to arrest them. But guess what? If they find any UFOs descending, they're going to arrest them, too.
Ha!
Capture them for evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Thomas.
I can just see
Thomas,
that.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Okay.
We have used up all of our time. And,
okay.
Hey, thanks again. And
no problem. Thanks a lot.
And listeners, this is the end of the New American Dream Radio Show for the 10th of October, 2019. And thank you all for listening. I hope you'll be back next week and every week right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.